Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. It is afternoon, right? Yeah, okay. Who even knows? I hope everybody's had a great con. Thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm going to introduce myself and my fellow panelists, and then we will get started. My name is Nadia. For those of you who have not been in the Electronic Frontiers Forum yet this weekend, I'm an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and one of the things that I work on is domestic surveillance, NSA spying, and also spying by local law enforcement. And we can just start to my left. Blair, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Blair Chintella. I'm an attorney. I practice law here in the Atlanta area and other parts of Georgia. And I also focus on Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment issues, and NSA surveillance.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. In fact, for those of you who've seen me already somewhere at the Electronic Frontiers Forum, my name is still Amy Stepanovich. I am still U.S. Policy Manager, as far as I know, at Access Now, working on privacy, free speech, other human rights from a technology angle, and how those intersect.
My name is Jeff Termeshazen. I'm a technical consultant with ACI Worldwide Payments, and we get monitored a lot.
So I'm going to start off by just giving the most brief background ever, and then just asking one question, and then we'll just go from there. So this is a pretty big topic to cover, domestic surveillance and backdoors. So I'll just give a little bit of background for folks who don't know. The debate around backdoors has to do with basically the government either strongly requesting and mandating in some cases under the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, ways that law enforcement can access data. So sometimes that has to do with just basic access, and that's more what CLIA has to do with. Sometimes it has to do with actually inserting weaknesses or vulnerabilities into standards that we use every day. So, of course, a huge example of this that got a lot of publicity was came out of the Snowden documents, and this is when it was discovered that RSA and the NSA had a contract, and essentially the NSA was responsible for having this weakened standard be the most commonly used standard in RSA products. And of course, RSA is a huge leader in the security industry. So usually when we say backdoors, we're talking about these sort of backdoors into products and services. There's also a loophole that allows the government to access Americans' communications without a warrant, and that's the Section 702 backdoor. So that's the other way you might hear that used. And the reason I mentioned both of them is because these are often discussed at the same time in Congress. So domestic surveillance, I'm not going to give much of a background on that. I'll just say that the current state of play when it comes to mass surveillance by the NSA, which of course was thrust into public light on June 5th, 2013. I had to pause
we
for a second.
We haven't slept a lot since then.
Yeah. I had to pause for a second because it's been a very packed 2 years. So, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been concerned about domestic surveillance for a long time, since before 2013. We were actually suing the NSA as early as 2008. We had a case against the NSA based on a whistleblower from AT&T who discovered this secret room at AT&T where he believed all of the communications were being copied. So we've been suing them for a long time. We were very excited after the leaks to see everybody get really upset about what was going on. I'll just say that some legislation was passed when Section 215 of the Patriot Act came up for renewal. We can talk about that if people have questions. I think we're mostly going to do Q&A, just to give you some sort of fodder for questions, although I'll bet you all have some already. So that's a little bit scattered. I think I will leave it up to the rest of the panelists to sort of mention what they think is, if you could just pick the top thing that you would like everybody to know about domestic surveillance or about backdoors, maybe we could throw that out there and then open it up for questions. So Blair, I'm gonna put you on the spot again, starting right at my left.
All right. One of the handouts that I brought today, I don't think I brought enough copies, but it's the ProPublica printout, and if you don't have a copy, you can go to their website and search for it. But basically, What it is a table of kind of the main programs that have been revealed by the disclosures from Edward Snowden. And I'll just kind of give you a quick rundown of some of them. So, for example, there's something called egotistical goat and egotistical giraffe, which is basically a program that was aimed at defeating Tor, which is an online browsing platform that is supposed to keep you anonymous when you're on the internet. So there are a lot of different other programs like quantum theory, which is basically a system set up to intercept traffic and then insert packets that are malicious between two points on a network. Muscular, which was aimed at infiltrating the data centers and the data of Yahoo and Google. So with that particular program, they couldn't do it legally within the United States, and so this muscular program moved out into the middle of the ocean where they tapped the fiber optic cables and got the information. So stuff like that. It's all in this printout. Prism, which is collecting information from U.S. companies. They've even tested extracting people's personal information from the Angry Birds app. I've never played it, but apparently. So, I mean, any possible way you can think that, you know, for them to get data, they're working on it. And some of it's foreign, some of it's domestic. So I think that's an important distinction we're going to kind of talk about today. There's the metadata collection, which is foreign, but is also domestic. And recently, the USA Freedom Act was passed, which basically the NSA is no longer collecting this metadata or will no longer be collecting in the future. There's a sunset kind of situation going on with that law. But then the telecoms will actually be required to hold this data. So for all intents and purposes, there's very little change. That's probably the biggest change that's happened, but in the grand scheme of all these disclosures, it's relatively small, I think. So I would just encourage you to go to this website. They have a great summary, and the EFF has a lot of resources as well. Other organizations like Electronic Privacy Information Center and Access Now. With that, I'll just pass it on.
So I'll make three fairly quick points. The first one is that they're actually, before I do this, a really great resource for all of you if you're typing it in or taking notes. Access held a crypto summit back in July. What we did is we brought all of the experts together, and we have the videos from that. There was a summary of the crypto history. There's a panel on the technology of encryption, all those videos. We also created really huge graphics to map out the history of the crypto summit, and that's on accessnow.org/events/crypto summit. Very great if you are interested in cryptography. So the three quick points I'm going to make. One is that there's lots of different types of encryption. There's encryption that encrypts your traffic as it's flowing. There is the encryption that is encrypting your hard drive, and that is a different technology. What we really like is the end-to-end encryption for traffic, where you have a key, the person you're sending something to has a key, and never between those two of you can that, unless you give that key out to somebody or your key is compromised, you can't really access that. It's the opposite of when you're having a company transmit something for you and they can access your information on their servers. It's really the strongest so long as you're good at protecting your key. So we encourage companies to encrypt their data. But because of backdoors and because of the ways government interact with that data, sometimes there are ways for that to be undermined. Three quick ways for that is either some sort of backdoor, either a mandated backdoor, a judicially ordered backdoor, or some companies voluntarily put backdoors in their products. And these allow governments and other actors to bypass the encryption and to go through a different way to get access to your data. And there's a lot of different ways those have been made available. The Washington Post likes to think that there can be some golden key that can provide only government access to your data. Technologists largely believe this is impossible and that once you have a backdoor built in, it's gonna be pretty much accessible by anybody who can figure out where it is. There is the idea that you can undermine encryption standards and provide yourself with a backdoor, which the NSA has been doing. There is a very small federal agency called the National Institute for Standards and Technologies that develops the standards on which encryption ends up being built. that agency is required to consult with the NSA as they develop those standards, mainly because the NSA is supposed to be the tech experts and they're supposed to provide technical expertise. Unfortunately, what the NSA does is what Edward Snowden has revealed is that they undermine the standards and they artificially weaken them in order to provide themselves access. They want to make sure that the standards are only so high so that they can still break into them and gain access to your communications. So that's another way backdoors can be formed. And then a third way, which isn't really backdoors, but it's government hacking. Governments going to your device or going to your phone, some way getting into the device and providing themselves access directly by somehow hardwiring their way in. And then my last point really quick is that it's not just the US doing this. It's Russia, it's China, it's the UK, and I will talk about that in a little bit. And it's not just us. In the US, there tends to be the idea that, you know, we're all out for each other and the US should, people in the US should be protected. But there are a lot of people, innocent people all over the world who are really, really incredibly impacted by the idea that people can break into their communications. And sometimes it's a matter of life or death. So when we talk about crypto backdoors, it really impacts everybody around the world. And it's a problem that governments all over the world are trying to get in on.
The point I want to make is kind of to build on Amy's. It was either late last year or earlier this year where iOS and Android locked down their systems, or at least Google locked down their systems. And there's a huge outcry from the law enforcement agencies. In particular, the FBI director went on record saying, you know, basically these companies are now enabling pedophiles. So please be aware of that kind of thing, simply because that's one of the first screams that get heard. It's like protect the some group, and it's usually the kids because people have such a reaction to it. Whenever you hear that, by default, be suspicious of it, because certainly it does benefit them, but it's also very much an excuse for them, basically, because we really don't have, compared to the population, the necessity for backdoors to access those cases does not warrant or does not justify having backdoors to access everyone's device. So while there is definitely a need for that, anyone who's saying that is usually promoting an agenda. So when they do ask things like that, question them on that. All right, what's the percentage? You know, is this the only way that you can possibly get this information? And it's rarely the only way that they can do that. There are usually ways, other ways that they can build cases like that.
And actually, just to add on to that, I kind of love this quote. This is from a hearing on encryption that happened just a couple of months ago. And this is Senator John McCain talking about why there needs to be a golden key into encrypted communications. I've heard my colleagues, with all due respect, talking about attacks on privacy and our constitutional rights, et cetera, but it seems to me that our first obligation is the protection of our citizenry against attack, which you agree is growing. I think there was a lot of people who sort of found it concerning that he would sort of et cetera, constitutional rights. And this was in the context of hearings where lawmakers were really trying to get numbers about how much of a problem encrypted communications are. There are no numbers out there. There's the only number that we got was from the Manhattan DA. I said this number earlier in a panel, so I apologize if you heard it before, saying that they had encountered, I think it was 78 iPhones where they couldn't break the encryption. They didn't even say exactly how they caused a problem. So let me see if there are questions. If there are already questions, we can take questions. Otherwise, we can. Oh, great. And we run out, then I will ask the panelists more things.
I'm hoping that someone can talk about the antecedents to domestic surveillance, because my understanding is that the Patriot Act was in play long before 9/11 happened. So there are historical, you know, precedents to these large-scale domestic surveillance programs, and I'm hoping that some or any of you can talk about those antecedents.
Yeah, there definitely were. For example, the FISA courts have been in the in existence since the early 70s. And basically, how many do not know what the FISA court is? Okay. All right, so what the FISA court is, it's this little, literally a single room sitting in an office building in, I think it's in D.C., where the government can go and get a warrant to pretty much do whatever they want as far as tapping people's communications. And there was a provision in there that you could go ahead and establish a tap without a warrant, and you get a warrant after the fact. What the Patriot Act really did was it opened that up in a significant way. It used to be that if you had something, you had to go get a FISA warrant. Very few people knew about that FISA court. The Patriot Act really didn't establish as much as expand what was on the books and expand the scope of what was there. And that was its major thing. It essentially established a standard where the government can get anything they want and they can try and justify it after the fact. That's really its biggest issue, is that scope change that it brought to the table.
And it's called the FISA Court. It's under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was basically passed, I believe, 1978?
Yes. Correct? October 5th, 1978.
Yeah, and it was in response to the Church Committee hearings because there was a bunch of spying going on during the Civil Rights era. And when all that information came out, there was an uproar kind of similar to what's happening today. And then that act was passed as a result. And then this court was basically established. But as it turns out, as these court orders, modern court orders, are being released, they're being criticized because they're so broad. They just basically say all the records of everyone in the country. And so kind of what was initially supposed to prevent abuse of the surveillance powers is kind of fostering it in a way. And so part of the debate is, you know, the procedures that are available in this court. As it stands right now, there's only the government can present arguments. It's in secret, it's not public. And so pundits will say, you know, it doesn't really resemble a court at all. And so at any rate, and that's kind of the origin of it and what has preceded this whole debate. And so a lot of the debate in Congress and elsewhere surrounds, you know, the procedures available. Some have argued for an advocate in the FISA, or the FISC, as it's called, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. You know, advocate for civil liberties to actually get two sides of an argument. So.
Yeah, so a few things that are really necessary if we're going to talk about the FISA court. One is that before 1978, there was no court. So when government wanted to conduct surveillance, they said that they couldn't go to a public court to conduct surveillance because it was a matter of national security. So that's how we got a lot of secret programs. The FISA court was in reaction to that. It was a way to have judicial oversight in a national security environment where there previously was no judicial oversight. So it was a great reform. It was actually something in the 1970s that was trumpeted as a really great reform. And even to this day, in other countries, there isn't judicial oversight. In fact, in the UK, national security surveillance orders are approved by a magistrate, which is not separate from the branch that is requesting the surveillance. It's all within one branch. So at least the FISA court is in a separate branch of government. That is not to say it's great. And actually, in the USA Freedom Act that just got passed last year, it was the first bill that passed through Congress since 1978 that actually restrained the NSA and the ability for them to conduct surveillance. It pulled that back, and it created some new protections in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's still a secret court. In fact, if you try to get off the elevator in the U.S. District Courthouse where that court is, and I've tried this before, they will kindly escort you back onto the elevator and see you on your way. It is very secret. However, they now have to publish their major opinions. Anything that is new, a new interpretation or a substantial interpretation, has to be publicly made available. To the greatest extent possible with a few redactions, but they're supposed to not redact much. So that was actually a big win, so we'll know when things that are significant are coming out of the FISA court. And it did create, not an advocate per se, but a system for people who are not the government to be references for the court, either legal experts, constitutional experts, technologists, which is like, in DC, that's just beyond the realm of thinking that a court would bring in a technologist so they could actually understand the technology and not just like have no idea what's going on in the world. So they can actually bring these people in now and get advice on what this technology means and how it impacts people, which was really also a great thing. We would like to see these decisions made in public. We would like to see the FISA court be a public court. We think that's, you know, necessary for public accountability. But in the global realm of things, where things are really bad in other places, this is actually fairly significant that we at least have a system And we're going to push for further reforms of that system. But surveillance has been going on forever. If you're talking about, I mean, going back to the original question, we have moved, the problem is as surveillance gets cheaper and easier and more affordable for government, they tend to conduct more of it. And that has been the trend forever. Surveillance is cheaper, so let's do more. Let's surveil more people. And the internet is the great cheapener of surveillance because they can put a tap on a fiber and just collect all the unencrypted information that comes over that. And the encrypted information they also collect, and they see that as a reason to store it forever. If they can't read it, then they can just keep it until they can.
Actually, they do for 5 years. The NSA at least keeps it for 5 years simply for technology reasons, in that they don't have enough disk space to store it for
but
longer
they can.
Than that.
Procedures allow them to keep it forever.
Yeah. And the thinking is that just because we can't crack it today doesn't mean we can't crack it tomorrow.
So just a couple of things to add. One, so I'm not the history of FISA and the ways it's been amended since it passed, I'm not an expert, but I can say that even before the Patriot Act was passed, FISA had been amended several times, and that sort of politically speaking, that during the 90s, there was definitely a move to looking at certain political activities as domestic terrorism. So there was the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that was passed. And there was, there was a shift in the sort of national security culture that happened pre-9/11. And I think that's really all I needed to add. And the hand way in the back was first, and then we'll get up to the hand right here. Sorry, I wish I knew everybody's names. Then I'd be the NSA.
It seems that someone has said, to quote them, surveillance is the business model of the internet, meaning that a lot of private organizations are accumulating an amazing amount of data about everything that we search in a search engine. Does it really matter who has the massive data, whether it's government or private, because it can be hacked and stolen by anyone, wherever it resides.
Yes.
So the question is, does it make a difference if the government's got all the data or Google has all the data, if all the data exists and someone can break into it anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. The difference there is what they have and what they can use. For the government to make a case against someone, they have to be able to justify why they have this information and how they got it and how it's relevant. Like you're saying, anything can be hacked. The bad people don't really care. They're going to be trying to blackmail you with it. They're generally using the information whatever way they can. I know with the recent Ashley Madison hack, people actually started getting emails saying, hey, you were on the site. We found your information online. Pay us money or we're going to start telling all your friends about it. The government is obviously restrained from doing such a thing. So just because they have the information doesn't necessarily mean they can use it. So they are constrained. So that is very definitely an important consideration, at least when we're talking as far as surveillance goes. Now, that doesn't mean they can't use it in other ways. For example, one of the big issues that NSA had was they were sharing information with the DEA in something called parallel construction, where they would be monitoring for terrorism. They'd come across someone arranging a drug deal internally within the US, I mean. They'd pass that information onto the DEA with a caveat that you never got this from us, you've never spoken to us about this, but be in such and such a corner at such and such a time because you're going to have something go down you want to know about, and just make sure that you have a different reason or you have a legitimate reason for being there. So the government fortunately has to justify how and where it got the information from, for the most part. So it does matter where they get that from and where it's kept.
A few things to add, and there have been a lot of other panels, so I'm going to try to not repeat myself too much for what has been said earlier this weekend. The first is that there are companies out there who have fought tooth and nail against government surveillance. They have tried to make it so that the government can't get access to their user information. Off the top of my head is Yahoo, which fought in the FISA court in secret for a very long time to try to protect their user data. So there is that divide as well. When the government has to request it from a company, the company can then fight against it judicially, and we encourage them to do that. There's a matter of security. Somebody on a panel I was on earlier this week, and if it's anybody who's up here, I apologize. for calling them out, but said that, you know, nobody is going to protect your data as well as you protect your data. But the problem is, unless you're a technologist and you know all of the ways that your data isn't secure on your own server, sometimes there are companies who may protect your data better than you can, because you're going to do things that just are bad security practice without knowing it. So it is a matter of trust and making sure your data is as protected as possible. And maybe if it's very, you know, sensitive, you do want to keep that yourself, but you do want to make sure it's also protected against criminals and bad guys, as opposed to the government. So there's both concerns. And the final thing is just the collection itself. When companies collect your data, they are enabling government surveillance. Even if they fight against it, even if they're protecting it from criminals, the government, all governments all over the world, can compel them in many instances to release that data. And that's a problem. And one of the ways that we say that they should go about keeping that from being a problem is collecting as small amount of the data as possible. And we still encourage them to do that. We also think that it's great when companies are enabling end-to-end encryption, which I talked about earlier, and companies like Yahoo and Google are starting to recognize this. And so both of them have talked about enabling end-to-end encrypted email, where they will no longer have the data in your email. They're going to give that back to you if you use this end-to-end service that they're talking about deploying. And we're expecting to see that within the next year. So they are trying to make sure it's secure for you and that you have access to it and take their own access away.
I want to add one thing to that as well, to expand on that there, by protecting your own data. How many of you heard about the recent thing where CVS was not going to be doing Apple Pay? All right, so what happened was, there's a new standard coming out for payments next month, actually, where the liability for who's responsible for fraud is shifting. And it's pretty much moving from the bank to not the bank. And the general rule is, whoever in the chain has the weakest security becomes liable for the fraud, to basically make it up to the consumer. And one of the reasons that the pharmacies were not accepting Apple Pay was because they've still establishing their own little consortium of sharing information between themselves. So it's like Walmart and a couple others over there. They're looking to collect the data of how you shop, what you shop with, anytime you use a loyalty card, something along those lines, and then they share it between themselves. They will promise very happily they'll never sell your data, but they'll simply enter into a relationship with whoever they want to sell it to, and then they freely share their data with their business partners. So it may be fantastic that you're keeping all of your data safe on Google and Yahoo and whatnot, but it doesn't help when you're turning around and basically giving it away at CVS and Walgreens and Walmart and stuff like that. So be very aware of that when you guys are using the prescription drug, the RX discounts cards, when you're using loyalty cards. The reason they're offering you those benefits is because they're making a fortune selling your data on the back end.
So just as a question, what would you want in sort of the future for laws for the government to have good encryption for users, but then also ideally, what would you like the government to be allowed to access or not allowed to access? Like, in your ideal world, like, what would magically you'd want to have happen?
Amy actually talked about this on an earlier panel, where Europe has basically said your data belongs to you, and anyone who's using it, essentially, they do not own that data, you own that data. In my ideal world, it would be a case of, all right, if they want to sell your data, you get a cut of that. And at that point, you can then choose whether or not you want to, you know, get some money from what they're doing with it, or whether you're willing to you know, give up that money, and basically they can do nothing. They've got to scrub everything to do with you from their list.
So I think you were asking about surveillance laws and access to encrypted data, right? Okay.
Yeah, mostly about surveillance. Yeah. Like.
So yeah. So I also hope Amy will add to this. But I think there are some things that we have asked for over and over again in legislation that we would like to see. So in terms of the FISA court, I think this was mentioned, right, having an advocate for privacy in the FISA court We have the amicus provision of USA Freedom, seeing somebody who had even more power, had more independence, seeing the classification system needs to be fixed. I mean, this is a huge problem. I guess just more narrowly focused specifically on encryption. I mean, EFF has a pretty clear position on that. We think encryption needs to be freely available, and it should not ever, there should never be a backdoor. There is no technologically feasible solution that would allow for a backdoor that it's just not possible right now. And we've had like the leading computer scientists all come to, or leading security experts all come together to say this. I mean, they sent a letter to Congress to say this, and this is the first time they've said anything together in this fashion since the government was trying to push the Clipper chip. So technologically, it is not feasible in a way that will not make everybody else less safe. So that can't be the solution. So the solution needs to be the judicial process in the way that it has been for a very long time in this country. I think one of the best quotes that I heard about trying to make any kind of encryption illegal and trying to create some sort of special backdoor, I think this was in Medium, it was the "Let's Make Curtains Illegal" article, mm-hmm. right? We have to accept as a society, if we still believe in the Constitution and we still believe in the idea that letting guilty people go free in order to have privacy for other people, to have rights for other people, I think we need to agree that that's the case here too. And what we're seeing is government essentially trying to say that they don't believe that anymore, but that, you know, they don't want to come out and say it, other than kind of John McCain. I think you probably have a more constructive thing to say than me.
So there's a document called, and this is a mouthful, I apologize, the International Principles on the Application of Human Rights to Communication Surveillance. Also called the Necessary and Proportionate Principles, and conveniently at necessaryandproportionate.org. And those are 13 principles that are supposed to, in a human rights respecting world, guide what surveillance law and policy looks like. And actually, I recently had the tremendous opportunity, and by recently I mean over the last year and a half plus, to write a document that is like, in an ideal world, which is what you asked, This is the implementation guide for the principles. This is what we think surveillance law, policy, and procedure should look like in the most ideal world possible. One of those things was there should be no bulk surveillance. There's no way that everybody is involved in a crime. Surveillance should be targeted. It should be looking at the individuals that they're going to get criminal information from. There should be no backdoors. It's a very long document, but there's a really great executive summary at the beginning that basically talks about here is the ideal world and what we are pushing for and why we're pushing in that direction. But then it goes through the entire, it goes through a step-by-step process from conceiving that you want to conduct surveillance as a government agent through the process of either requesting that information internationally, judicial review. It is that process instead of the principles process of saying this is what the whole process should look like. And so we have done that whole ideal world scenario and published something that we think is that piece.
Thank you.
I guess one thing I would just add real quick would be there are basically national security letters, and companies are prohibited from disclosing the existence of it. So not only does the user not even have an ability to challenge it, they don't even know it exists. So they don't even know it exists, so they can challenge it. So that's a huge, huge thing. And there are a lot of those that go out, in other types of process, basically that are basically gag orders attached to them. So, I mean, I think that there's a time and place for those, but I think it needs to be severely limited. Right now, they're just, the volume of those types of subpoenas and process going out is very large. And it's very flimsy as far as, you know, it just requires a certification or something signed by, you know, a bureaucrat, a high-ranking bureaucrat, and that's it. And then, you know, it's extremely hard to finally find out about it. A couple people have, and people have argued that it even prohibits a person who receives it from speaking with an attorney. So it's a huge problem. It kind of goes along with the classification. And I think there needs to be more processes set up, even if they are restricted or sealed or whatever.
I don't know what order people raise their hands in, so you're just going to have to pick.
So I think the EU came out with a great document a while back about they were looking into building their own NIST, right? They say, what is going to be the undertaking for building our own encryption standards body instead of relying on what comes out of the US? And the TLDR version was, it's going to take a lot of people, and we just want to make an open, they don't believe, right, the government should own a math equation. Mm-hmm. So it's what open standards body is now being formed to handle that? Is that, I'm probably lacking some knowledge on, I just want to know where mm-hmm. that's going, because they recognize it and says, we're not going to build our own NIST.
Yeah.
Let's make it open.
The short answer is I don't know. I will say one of the things that we are trying to do legislatively is divorce NIST from the NSA,
right.
Make it so that they no longer have to consult with the NSA on standards, give it a permissive standard. Very little known. NSA has two missions. One is signals intelligence, that's surveillance. One is information assurance, which is protecting. It is making sure that NIST is only consulting with the NSA in furtherance of information assurance and not signals intelligence. So we're trying to do that legislatively. We're also trying to get them more resources, and it's so hard.
It's a human.
Their funding bill this year, they tried to cut out their funding to pre-2014 levels and give extra funding to the FBI to hack into computers. It was ridiculous. It wasn't even like they requested more money for 2016 than they had received in 2015. And instead of giving them more money, they gave them significantly less to develop standards and to evolve as an agency that should be independent and should have its own technologists. Instead, they really decided that the money should be going to the FBI so that they could make everybody in this room and around the country and around the world just a little bit less secure. And we fought against that, and actually we got their funding re-upped. So they will be funded at 2016 levels, which is great. The FBI, unfortunately, is also getting that money.
So is the divorce still happening between the two at some point, or is that still a work in process?
It's still a work in progress. We've had a lot of amendments introduced on this. Every time an amendment that I know of on this subject has been introduced, it's passed. It's a matter of getting it past both houses of Congress at the same time in the same bill, and that has not yet happened. But there are people who are working on this. One of them, is anybody here from Florida? Yeah. Representative Grayson from Florida has championed this topic and has been fairly good on it, and so he's still fighting for it.
Like Blair said, there definitely is a need for some government security because there are criminals out there. I think the biggest problem there is that the government has abused the powers that they have had in the past. And our pretty much reaction is that, well, you guys essentially screwed the pooch with the trust that we did give you, therefore we're not going to trust you with anything. If you guys actually had used this responsibly from the get-go, it would be a whole different matter. But right now, there's no way we can trust you because you have been repeatedly caught and you have repeatedly demonstrated that we can trust you with this because you try and expand it way beyond both what we're comfortable with and with what the physical letter of the law says. And I don't know that the government will be able to get that trust back again without essentially resetting the whole thing, and I just don't think that's going
to
happen.
Well, it's very hard to get that trust back. Here's a quote from President Obama. It said, August 6, 2013, says, "We don't have a domestic spying program. There is no spying on Americans." So you can look at the stuff online and you can evaluate whether that's a truthful statement or not.
NIST is developing a document. We've commented on it. They've actually gone through two, mostly federal agency publishes a document, you provide comments, and then they publish a final version. Here they published a document on how they were going to do standards. We provided very long comments. Then they published another draft, and they were like, actually, we want more comments. So then we provided another round of comments. We're still waiting on the final version, but they're trying to get a document that will guide their standard setting process that will try to move toward getting that trust back. But the people I know in the agency recognize that there is a big deficit there.
I had a quick question regarding, not quick, but a question regarding just what's going on with data scrubbing. Jeff mentioned specifically, you know, in his ideal world, you'd be able to opt out of this data collection essentially without taking a cut. And I know that I had read, I guess somewhere in some Eurocourt, that it had been decided that a citizen could contact Google to have search information scrubbed.
Correct.
So is there any sort of push being made to, I guess, for more of a larger sweep anywhere, like in any different zone or legal system where you could possibly scrub any movement?
No. Even in the Europe case, it was limited to Google. Google was the only one who was actually required by law to do that. Now, as that changed, well, initially they were. Other companies then started doing it because they could see where this was going. Now, I don't know if apparently the law has been expanded to include others as well. But initially it was very specific to Google only, based on that. And I don't think anything like that's made it as far as being anywhere close to implementation on the US side. Thanks to the NSLs and stuff, a lot of times you can't even get the information that that someone searched for you, essentially, as far as that goes. And I think we are going to have a problem getting anything similar to that being passed, simply because of the whole, you know, think of the children type argument that anytime someone mentions that, sort of that's the fallback point, and you wind up looking like a jerk because, you know, I want my data to be safe, and therefore I'm promoting pedophilia. So yeah, we're going to have a tough time with that.
Yeah, it's recently with the right to be forgotten stuff. There's actually been one of the sites I sometimes contribute to tech, that they actually got a request just a week or two ago requesting an article to be removed about them writing about an article that was removed. So yeah, it was actually becoming a meta thing, in effect, mm-hmm. because it was the original request that reporting on the thing removed is now being removed. So they wrote another piece. So the original's been removed, the thing about it's been removed, and now there's a third piece. You have to follow three links in the chain to even find it now. So it's becoming a big problem with being removed, people trying to hide things. That in this case, it was a criminal conviction that was being, he wanted it hidden so it wouldn't be done. He was even trying to be using copyright law to get it done.
See, I'll be willing to bet, though, if anything like that did pass in the U.S., one, it would be against a whole lot of opposition. And as soon as if it did ever pass, you'd have agencies doing the same thing. Like anyone who complained about them, they'd say, all right, we're filing a request for you to take that down based on the following. And then we'd have a whole new battle to go and fight with there, where it's like, well, no, those are public records. You can't do that. And
First Amendment as well.
Yeah.
So the right to be, for those who don't know about the right to be forgotten, it is the ability for you to go and request that search results about you be removed. This is now in the EU. Members of the EU government, one of the bodies, has requested that Google also extend that protection to other people outside of the EU, which Google has politely said, no, thank you. There is, in the United States, a great deal of tension between free speech and privacy, which is why that hasn't really taken off here just yet. In the EU, it is much more of a privacy-focused society.
So that was France, and just to clarify, it's that, so the right to be forgotten now, if I go to google.co.uk, right, that the right to be forgotten within the UK means that those requests can be within the EU, that those requests can be taken down on those sites, only where the right to be forgotten is applicable. And Google said no to making that. So if I were to google.com, right, in the States, they wanted that to be global. So this is what Google said no to.
Okay, I guess my parting thought on that would be, the data I would be specifically referring to wouldn't necessarily be in the public eye, so it would be your personal data that's being, you know, thrown around, and as Geoff said, it's mainly hidden, but yeah, so, yeah.
I know that as far as domestic surveillance, you know, obviously since you're judicially going after some of these groups and corporations and government, you find out a lot of things through discovery process, right? Maybe. One of the things that I'm curious about is, and some of us couldn't be at all the panels, but I am curious about this. Did anybody touch on this weekend about all the internet-connected appliances this weekend? A lot of us have heard things about the Xbox and, you know, about cable boxes and the new internet-controlled refrigerators, you know. In other words, as a consumer, are we going to be looking at situations like the Xbox when it comes to smart devices within the home?
So Jeff and I and Kit Walsh from EFF were on a panel at 10 a.m. this morning, which you all probably slept through, which I'm a little bit jealous of, talking about the Internet of Things and security. And so the long and short of it was that they're not really talking about security yet. Companies making Internet of Things devices. I will, Jeff, do you want to add a TLDR about that panel?
Sure. Basically, it came down to that it's not going to happen if something bad happens, because both companies and Congress tend to be reactive more than proactive. And essentially, we're going to have two fights. One is to get it established, and then two, once they overreach in the establishment after something bad happening, we have to then fight the next battle to get it cut down to where it should have been in the first place.
Thank you.
I didn't back
to be. I'm a registered nurse, and as the government is taking over healthcare and collecting all this data, I'm stunned how much data they're collecting. And then I found out 35 governmental agencies have access to all of our healthcare information once they figure out all this internet stuff. So I have great concerns, not only for myself, but the patients and everyone about it. Seems like it's going to be a free-for-all with all that data that they're collecting. And it's not just health information, it's other stuff too.
Mm-hmm. And so the U.S. has a sectoral approach to privacy as opposed to the EU. The EU has general privacy laws. The U.S. is like, here's your credit privacy and here's your health privacy. And health actually has a privacy law, and still that is the environment that's happening. So imagine the unregulated industries where your information is kind of flowing back and forth. That is one of the problems. Post 9/11, they identified that government agencies needed to communicate with themselves more and that information needed to be shared more. We would like to see some more accountability on where that information is going, and specifically with Internet of Things connected medical devices to tie a lot of different things in together, which bleed a lot of the most sensitive data. That absolutely needs to be protected through encryption, through data security, and through making sure it's only going to the doctors or nurses that it needs to go to and isn't bleeding out into the world.
They're collecting information about social things and other things that are not necessarily what I have ever learned as far as healthcare stuff is. So they're going to know things about you that aren't necessarily healthcare related.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even with that, I know HIPAA's got a number of, HIPAA's the law that covers healthcare. There are a lot of conflicting sections within that. So it's almost impossible for someone to actually comply with HIPAA because of those conflicting controls between there. So yeah, a lot of it goes back to what they can get and what they can use. But unfortunately, especially on the malicious side, what can be used against you is usually significantly greater than what can be legally used against you.
My question and comment kind of segues exactly on what she was just mentioning. There's been a legislative move to make more and more of your information public and to declare it public, especially with the finance campaign laws. And so people are getting more and more information. Like, for example, in that particular piece of legislation, you have to report if somebody's retired or their occupation.
I think there's a growing connection between the private sector and government as well. Like, kind of made me think of that. Like, there's CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing Protection Act, which is still being battled out, and there have been multiple iterations of it. Basically, one of the controversial provisions of it is saying that private companies have a duty or at least can give information to the government whenever they think some sort of criminal behavior is going on or something that affects national security. You look at the different versions of the legislation, you'll see different definitions of when they can or can't do this. But there's definitely a push in a way to create legislation where it fosters a really close relationship between private companies just handing over information to the federal government and that kind of thing. So,
okay. My question is kind of weird. When the government has information, you want it, and you're looking for things like exculpatory evidence, where like maybe a DA or a prosecutor is withholding the information from you, are there any, like, okay, they have the right through the FISC courts and FISA to go through our data and get warrants on us. Is there any way we can search their data?
Just missing.
Oh.
The Freedom of Information Act is like right before this.
Oh, okay.
Now that being said,
well, don't kill a dead horse. You already talked about. I missed that one. Yeah.
Now that being said, there are a lot of resources out there on how to do your own Freedom of Information Act or how to do your own Public Records Act request if you're looking for information on a state level government agency. That would be your state law. If you want to do it federal, that's FOIA. And I actually strongly recommend, if you've ever been involved in any sort of political activity or if you have any reason whatsoever to think that you might have an FBI file, that's a really good way to get started doing FOIA requests. You can fill something out online, and it's pretty easy to do. And it will give you an idea of what sort of responses you're going to get, what sort of documents you're going to see. Also, if you go to EFF.org/NSA, that will give you the complete NSA timeline. It's about a month behind, which is my fault because I'm the person who maintains it now. We have links to all the original Snowden documents on a time, and we have a timeline just explaining when all the leaks came out. And that's another, I think, looking at those documents, there's more in there than anybody could really imagine. Like there's some out there. The other thing is, if you ever have the opportunity to support more protections for whistleblowers, absolutely do that. Because of course Snowden was a whistleblower, Manning was a whistleblower. You know, it's whistleblowers that people who put their own lives in danger, and we've seen what happens to them when they are prosecuted, who allow us to know exactly what is going on. So they're incredibly important, and they don't have enough protections.
And I'm going to channel Nadia a little bit and put on my Nadia hat. There are a lot of ways that local law enforcement are starting to collect more information about you. And they're actually, in some cases, like body cameras, developing policies about how that information is going to be used. One of the things that you really want to make sure it can be used for is that you can access your own, like if there's videos that you are in, that you can access those videos and that they can be used not only to protect officers, but also as exculpatory evidence when they show that the person who has been picked up or arrested or whatever has happened hasn't done anything wrong. So you want to make sure that they can be used in both directions.
Actually, if you go to EFF.org/DragonConFOIA, that's actually a link that Dave Moss from the EFF set up during the last panel. And you'll actually see some requests that he filed during the last panel. And there was a couple different places they went to. There are a number of police departments that were queried, and there was also another one for the Idaho National Laboratory, which was nuclear waste management, was the request for that one. So EFF.org/DragonConFOIA.
Yeah, and actually that will lead you to muckrock.com, which is a company that will do requests for you if you can't do them yourself. And they charge a pretty small fee, so that's another option. But I love that Dave set that link up. I just went and looked at it. Check it out.
I'd like to follow up on my question, maybe more of a statement, and then I would like you to please react to the statement, which is that it doesn't matter who has the data. If the data exists, it belongs to whoever can decrypt and hack it. Basically, it's up for grabs, whoever has the data. So it doesn't matter if the government has it or Google has it or someone who was surveilling my toaster in the Internet of Things. If it exists anywhere, it belongs to the best hacker and the best decryptor. It's basically almost public anyway. So please react to that statement.
I mean, the best hacker and the best decryptor are not public. I don't think that those two are equate to one another.
Well, docs, for example. I mean, once they get the information, if they want to do doxing, they can put it in a place where it belongs to everyone. So it's potentially public.
Well, the difference between it being accessible to everyone and belonging to everyone, that's actually where the laws are very useful, because let's say they do publish it somewhere that it becomes available to everyone. That doesn't mean everyone owns it, because you could still go sue them for libel or slander, depending on how it's used. So it goes back to what people have versus what they can use against you.
So I also think that not to, I don't want to sound confrontational, but I think you have a fundamental misunderstanding of the use of data, right? So I have talked in every panel I've been on now about threat modeling. So threat modeling is asking yourself questions about your data and what you want to protect and who you want to protect it from. So you're thinking about why people would want to access your data. And the point I'm making is that the government and companies have very different motivations. Companies want to make money. They want to make money in whatever way they can make money, and they want to make money in the easiest way, so sometimes that means that they're going to comply with government requests. Hackers have different motivations. I have been targeted for hackers because of comments about feminism that they didn't like. They're really, really bad hackers, so they didn't do very well. You mentioned doxing, right? They went and tried to find public information and put it up, and they've tried to do other things. They have a very different motivation from, for instance, the United States government. They have a very different motivation from Facebook. And the point I'm making is, yes, if you actually were to combine all the data that was out there about you, there would be a complete picture. It would be a nightmare. But that data is not available to everybody at all times. Not all hackers. Hashtag not all hackers. But I mean, I'm joking,
yes,
but I'm also
all
being
hackers.
I'm joking, but I'm also being serious that it still does matter. The laws that are in place still matter. The different security at different companies that are holding your data matters. The different capabilities of different people who would want to access your data matter. All of those things matter. It does matter. It does matter what the government is doing because they don't have access to all those things. It does matter what security there is in place because not every hacker can get into every system. We are not in some sort of post-apocalyptic data nightmare where everybody knows everything and everything is accessible all the time. So don't worry, we're not there yet.
Now, I will say one thing. There is an argument actually in favor of that, just take the other side of the argument. Iceland actually has a rule where their version of the Social Security is actually public. You can look up anyone's Social Security number. The way they sort of get around that is that you have a picture ID which is also tied to that. So pretty much anyone, if you walk into a store and they ask for your Social Security number, you can give it to them because it actually benefits you, because they can simply do a quick search and see, is the person who's in front of me the same person that the government has on record? Now obviously we've got a much more insulated society, but when used appropriately there is an argument for the other side, because right now in the US, if someone's got your Social Security number, they can do all kinds of bad things against you, where that becomes much, much harder in countries like Iceland, simply because anyone can go query their database and see whether or not this person is the person who's actually, you know, making a request or standing in front of me.
I'm just curious if you know if there's any particular programs or the government allows surveillance of military families.
So I do know that military families, if you are living on a base, there are different laws that apply. I don't know exactly how that, specifically how that affects surveillance. I think I could find the answer, but I don't know it off the top of my head, and I don't want to give you incorrect information.
Because my son was actually promoted, whatever, to a special forces unit. And he told me that they sat down and went through all of our Facebook pages with him, and things were deleted. And I've noticed, I'll go into certain things in my internet accounts, and things will be gone.
Some of that
and
could be.
And also, I'll be having phone conversations, and I'll hear clicks and weird. I may just be paranoid, but it's only been since my son was put into special forces.
When I was discharged from the military, I shipped a huge box back to my parents' house, and when it got there, there were cables unplugged within my computer. So essentially they had gone through and scanned everything on my computer. So it happens, but I would be willing to follow up with you legally and look into that actually, because that's an interesting.
Sure. And also my son was told too, you know, that military families are being targeted by ISIS. Like, I couldn't even put stickers on my car, like Army Mom or anything like that, or anything with his unit in particular, which kind of sucks because I'm proud of him.
Well, there is a good and a bad thing to that. I've got a brother who's in the military as well. And especially in cases where they do go into very sensitive areas like special forces, things like that, you really want to downplay your involvement there, specifically because...
I understand it's for our protection.
Right, no, well, it's not just that. I know with SEAL Team 6, their families did actually get threats and things for those who had been sort of outed as being members of that after they took down Bin Laden. So, I don't know how big of a threat that it is, but it is absolutely an active and viable threat. And they do go through and scrub because there's been more than one, and not even special forces, just regular military folk, who've posted deployment information or other information they really should not have, similar to what Geraldo did before he got kicked out of being embedded, perfectly innocently, but it's information that is absolutely useful to people who are against our interests. So that is an active concern.
Yeah, if you want to give me your information after, I can try and find an answer for you, actually.
Well, he mentioned SEAL Team 6. Actually, my son is the unit that flies them around. Thank you.
Contractors, too, sometimes in the works. My dad did 2 years over there. He had external hard drives that were sent back that were disassembled when they came to me. And they had stickers on there that said, you know, this has been inspected.
Not like glue. There's no stickers on my stuff, just...
So the one other just practical thing I would say is that if you're concerned about any of your sort of social media settings or you want different ways to communicate, you can check out Surveillance Self-Defense. It's we did a panel on it yesterday on using encrypted email and things like that. You don't have to be a computer expert. Some of it is just tips for your own privacy. Just go to ssd.eff.org. And I can write that down for you afterwards. But I think following up with Blair would be a really good idea. I think this is our last question that we can take, and I know there were others. I'm really sorry, but whoever has the mic, go.
I'll try to keep it really quick so you guys can talk some more. Back to medical stuff that she was talking about. One of the things is it just seems like there's so much more medical data and non-medical data being forced to be, you know, I'm a doctor, and I'm being asked to gather data on my patients that really creeps me out. And what I'm being asked to do with the data really creeps me out. And then when I try to go access medical care and not participate in that data, I find that it's really hard to get medical care. And I don't find that HIPAA and the High Tech Act are helping patients and patient care, and it's all done in the matter of saving money or quality. Like, any comments on that? And I'd love to hear what the European aspect is of protecting that medical data, because we talk about surveillance of our finances, but surveillance of our medical data and access to that, you know, the power in that is just very scary.
So I don't work, there is a whole body of law specifically on health privacy. My very short reaction is actually Dr. Deborah Peel runs Patient Privacy Rights out of Austin, Texas. She's amazing. The organization is amazing. On this specific issue, you're not going to find a better resource. And I would follow up with her directly, and she'll probably reach Dr. Deborah Peel with Patient Privacy Rights. And she runs an annual conference in Washington, D.C. specifically on health privacy.
And if you're in the medical profession, I think there's more of a need for more people to get involved. So definitely check that out.
Excuse me, can I say something real quick? My name is Daniel Karpov, and I'm here to say God bless America.
All right.
That was recorded. Good job. I think we do have to wrap up. he might have just wanted to get it on the recording for the NSA so they can review it later. I mean, I'm 100% certain that's why I just did that. I also love the USA.
Ditto.
Yeah. So I apologize for anybody who didn't get to ask questions. I know some of us have flights to catch, so we do have to wrap up on time. But thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.